14 years, gone on 15. Albert has done 14 years more than I've done.
I wanted to end with Albert Woodfox's words back in 2010.
Our primary objective is that Frankie. That is what we are struggling for, and we are actually fighting for our freedom. We are fighting for the people to understand that we will...
This call originates from a Louisiana correctional facility and may be recorded or monitored.
That we were fighting for murder that we are totally and completely and actually innocent of.
You have 15 seconds left on this call.
Let me call you back.
That was Albert Woodfox from the 2010 documentary In the Land of the Free. And that does it for our show. George Kendall and Robert King, thanks so much for being with us. Democracy Now! Is hiring a senior news producer and an engagement editor. Find out more at democracynow.org, both full-time jobs. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Renee Feld, Saren Mate, Nermeen Sheikh, Steve Martinez, Sam Malkoff, Hani Massoud, Ravi Karan, Dina Guzder, Amy Littlefield, Anna Ozbeck, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Nogueira, Aaron Janier. Special thanks to Becca Staley, Julie Crosby, Hugh Grant, David Prude, and Vesta Gadars. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez, our website, democracynow.org. Thanks for joining us.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, where the time is now 8:01. Coming up next is a special 2-hour-long episode of Wednesday Morning Talk Radio with our host, Paul Rowland.
This Wednesday afternoon, June 10th, from 12:30 to 1:30, noted author and social critic Chris Hedges will be at the station to meet KBOO listeners and sign copies of his new book, Wages of Rebellion. If you asked for a copy of the book as a thank you gift during our recent membership drive, come on down to pick it up and get it signed. There will also be some additional copies available for sale. That's this Wednesday afternoon at 12:30 here at KBOO, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, just off Burnside. And Wednesday evening at 7:30, Hedges will be at Powell's Bookstore on West Burnside to read from and sign copies of his book.
Come, freedom, come. Breathe in our spirits and blow out fire. Teach us your song that once was sung. One by one we will echo your verses. Teach us that song, the song of rebellion.
KBOO Community Radio is accepting Toys for a Toy Drive conducted by McLaren's leadership in collaboration with McLaren Community Voice. The toys will be used during family visits for young family members visiting their loved ones in the McLaren Youth Authority. KBOO will have a barrel in their lobby from June 2nd to the 14th and will accept toys, stuffed animals in new or gently used condition. We will not turn down any donations. Your donations will be greatly appreciated. Thank you.
KBOO is a proud sponsor of One Flaming Arrow, an intertribal art, music, and film festival curated by RISE, Radical Indigenous Survivance and Empowerment. This event will take place from June 2nd through the 14th at Surplus Space and multiple venues within Portland, Oregon, Indigenous lands of the Chinook tribe. One Flaming Arrow seeks to evolve the dialogue of Indigenous survivance by introducing a biennial art, music, and film festival. The festival advocates Native expression of autonomy through the warrior spirit. It stands to disrupt the hegemonic white noise of contemporary culture by focusing on non-conventional exhibition spaces and non-neo-traditional Native artists, spaces created for the radically political, experimental, and emerging. Surplus Space, located at 3726 Northeast 7th Avenue, Portland, Oregon. For more information, visit oneflamingarrow.com. Special thanks to PICA's Precipice Fund, Caligram Foundation, and the Andy Warhol Foundation for the Visual Arts.
They They said this was all unprecedented, but they lied. I have seen this before. Like a momentary glimpse of deja vu, we have all seen this before. A childhood dream long forgotten, an aging hope drowned in tears we dare not mention. We have all seen this before, nesting in our souls, waiting to hatch, waiting to fly higher. Come, freedom, come, breathe in our spirits and blow out fire. Teach us your song that once was sung. One by one we will echo your verses. Teach us that song, the song of rebellion. I know these words, our lullaby when we were born free. There were no chains, just a crown of dignity placed on our heads. But we forgot our song, blinded by portraits of tyrants polluting our walls. Tear them down and draw pictures of our children. Write these poems across the skies. Rise, thunderous voices, rise. Let the earth rumble beneath their feet until their palms sweat, their knees shake, and they remember our song. Come, freedom, come. Teach us your song that will make pharaohs tremble. Do you hear them now? It's the Free Souls Ensemble, uttering words once forbidden, words we were scared to mention. Do you hear them now? They're singing our song. They're singing our song, the song of rebellion.
And good morning. Welcome to Wednesday Talk Radio. My name's Paul Roland. This is a special two-hour edition, as you've heard. We've got three guests in the studio, several guests who will be joining us by phone, and we've got some audio from past editions of this Resistance Ecology Conference that we're going to be talking about here this morning. So let me introduce guests going clockwise. Tim, say hi.
Hey, how's it going, Paul?
Justin.
Hey, how's it going? Thanks for having us.
Melanie.
Hi, thank you for having us.
All right. So I don't know which order y'all want to go in, who wants to talk first, but I was hoping you guys could just kind of give some background on a little bit about yourselves and a little bit about how you got involved in organizing this conference and what the reasons behind doing this conference are. This is a third edition, right? Mm-hmm.
This is the third edition. We're really excited that we're going to be bringing this back for a third year in a row. But just a little bit about Resistance Ecology. This was kind of born out of frustration for most of us in this room in the animal rights, animal liberation movement, which had a very, for years and years, has had a very single issue focus. It's been dominated by the nonprofit industrial complex, large groups like PETA, HSUS, Mercy for Animals.
So PETA is?
People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals.
And
HSUS is the Humane Society of the United States. Okay. And MFA, Mercy for Animals, is our common acronyms that are used. Myself, I was involved in a Portland group that was very active for many years, Portland Animal Defense League, and we were kind of, it's almost like screaming at a wall because we were throwing everything we had here in Portland at some of the targets that we chose, and it really felt like we were getting nowhere. So about 4 years ago, we decided that we would kind of end Portland Animal Defense League and focus all our efforts on resistance ecology, which was going to kind of change the way, and we were really pushing to change the way in which animal rights, grassroots animal rights, and animal liberation activists were thinking critically, were organizing, and trying to change the paradigm that was being dominated for the animal liberation movement. And so now we're really, through this conference, promoting a really critical analysis of how animal liberation activists organize their strategy and their critiques of themselves. This conference is going to be no different. So we're really excited about it.
Great. Anything to add?
That was a pretty good recap, Tim.
Fair enough. And Justin, mm-hmm. you've been involved from the beginning, right? Also,
yeah. Yeah, I share most of the same story that Tim just told. My background is mostly really just doing animal liberation organizing, and it is incredibly frustrating to deal with a movement that doesn't seem to have a really good grasp on sort of the structural underpinnings of animal exploitation. And so the conference has really been repeated attempts at looking at those different things, different institutions and systems like capitalism or settler colonialism, the ways in which, you know, anything from how borders change our relationship to not only other people, but other species, instead of creating a movement that just really wants to seek equality for animals under existing state structures. We would like to see a movement that is challenging those very structures as the things that are constantly reproducing animal harm, animal abuse, and along the way gain a better understanding of the other communities and movements that are impacted immensely by different iterations of those same institutions and structures. And so it's, you know, it's had different focuses each year, so to speak, but the common themes have always been about prison, prisoner support, prison abolition. This year is a bigger focus on land defense and indigenous resistance. We've had people discuss the ways in which communities of color are differentially impacted by things like food scarcity, food systems. Animal rights is obviously tend to be tied into food quite a bit because of a big focus on veganism in the mainstream movement. And those are sorts of things that we want to bring into a bigger holistic critique.
And Melanie, how'd you come into this?
Well, this is my first year organizing with Resistance Ecology. And I feel like me getting involved was kind of like out of a necessity, like in a lull of nobody really doing things. It kind of became just Tim and Justin doing all of Resistance Ecology. And I've been to past conferences, and so I always kind of had I was vibed with Resistance Ecology, I felt like. And then I got involved through the student group at PSU, Student Animal Liberation Coalition, which Tim is also a part of and Justin helped create. And so we kind of, Salk kind of, you know, morphed with Resistance Ecology and, you know, kind of worked like shared resources, I feel like. And so it kind of just out of, you know, needing more people to be doing things and to step up, I got involved in Resistance Ecology. It's been good. I like it.
So that group is still going, that Student Animal Liberation Coalition?
Yeah. We're still going strong, I would say. Have some, you know, exciting things planned for next year, hopefully. So that'll be good. Can, you know, focus more on campus next year, now that this conference will be passed, and then we can, you know, kind of chill on Resistance Ecology and focus on the other groups, and then, you know, focus on each one as needs arise.
Well, since this conference is happening at Portland State University, obviously you guys are very involved with it. Just to stay on that before we move on to kind of the conference itself and other issues. So are you, you know, the whole issue of intersectionality, which is obviously I've heard talked about a lot there, and obviously you guys have been talking that language in your introduction there. Is that, how is it working with other student groups on campus?
I think it's been a good way to actually like practice a lot of the things that we preach. You know, I feel like it's good to have a super, what is our acronym?
Students United for Palestinian Equal Rights.
Like it's good to, and we have the environmental club involved also. It's been good to kind of get a variety of perspectives from different student groups involved in the conference.
So some of them are actually helping actually with the organization of panels and stuff. Cool.
Well, I mean, they like, we have other student groups involved in like helping some of our speakers get here and, you know, stuff like that. So it's been good.
Yeah, it seems like, you know, just organizing in general, not just here in Portland, but nationally and internationally as well, when you see things on social media, is that everyone's kind of realizing that because not everyone's eyes are open to this kind of analysis, that everyone kind of needs to join forces. And so people are oftentimes willing to look past their differences and find that common thread so that things such as Resistance Ecology or, you know, it was Occupy Portland for a while in the past, or, you know, anytime there's any campus event, really, Students United for Palestinian Equal Rights, you know, Student Animal Liberation Coalition, Students for Unity, and a multitude of other organizations are sure to check in with each other and co-sponsor events. The same thing goes out into the community. Resistance Ecology and all of us here also have, you know, strong ties and relationships with Portland Central America Solidarity Committee and Rising Tide. And we all kind of, you know, share members and are sure to support each other's work.
I just want to add that those particular community organizations, PCASC and Rising Tide, are also plugged into the conference in terms of helping organize, presenting on panels, et cetera. And that's, again, that's been sort of a relationship building thing over the last 3-4 years. So both on off campus, it is definitely an exercise in practicing what we preach.
Well, speaking of which, I mean, I attempt to do that in my own way with this program. I certainly have a wide cross-section of issues and people coming to talk, but it would be really nice if we could have some of that in the program itself. So if anybody with those organizations that were mentioned, the student groups or the community groups, would like to call in, that would be really cool. So we could kind of have a bit of a roundtable discussion. The number is 503-231-8187. And as I said, we're going to have some people by phone who are going to be talking at the conference. And Steve, our engineer, I wonder if you could cue up number one on this CD I prepared for the show with some audio from past conferences. I just thought this is, you know, kind of taken up by the theme. This will maybe launch into a further discussion of kind of the connection between animal rights organizing and other organizing issues within. You mentioned sort of the like tension or a feeling of difference with the, you know, the bigger established, more mainstream animal rights groups, but there's also tension, maybe other kinds of tension. So anyway, let's just listen to Josh Harper.
My name is Josh Harper. I've been an activist here in the Pacific Northwest for going on 18 years. And I've participated, like Jake, in a wide variety of struggles. And most recently have been known for doing a little bit of federal time as part of the Shack 7 case. I guess the title of this panel is something like Animal Liberation and Wilderness, Match Made in Heaven or Odd Couple. It's sort of an odd title to me, though, because it suggests that the two could necessarily be pitted together, or that one doesn't directly feed the other. Oftentimes, when I'm talking to animal rights activists, I'm going to be honest here, I see a fair amount of closed-mindedness, and at times, almost a religious response to the way that we view the relationship between humans and non-humans. I grew up in Eugene, Oregon. When I was living there, it was when the Earth First Journal was still being published there. Some of the first campaigns that I went on were out in the forests of Oregon. And when you are in these places, you begin to realize just how much life inhabits them. And so I guess one of the things that I'm always trying to convey to animal liberation activists when they complain about, I met an environmentalist and they weren't a vegan, and how can they call themselves an environmentalist, and so on and so forth, is that, you know what? This is a community that's working to actively protect and preserve the homes of animals. This is a community who thinks about the size and scale of human society and wants to begin rolling it back. Right now, even those of us who are vegan, even those of us who are wearing breathable synthetic, you know, shoes and all of that, we are standing in devastated wilderness. This is a form of human imperialism where we are at right now. This is land that wasn't just stolen from indigenous communities, but the indigenous species who once lived here, plant and animal. At times, I wonder if animal rights folks are aware that the bottom line isn't veganism, the bottom line is animals. If we have communities who are willing to go out and take risks and fight to preserve this land and to roll back some of this human imperialism, I think we need to start thinking about the long game. I think we need to start thinking that, sure, You know, there are things that we would like to see changed. There are ideas that we would like to have considered. But in the meantime, perhaps we could start being a little less antagonistic, and that would make folks a little more willing to consider our position. When I first got involved, as I mentioned, I mean, there was that whole Earth First thing, but I didn't even realize that there was a split, you know? The folks that I looked up to early on were Jonathan Paul, they were Rod Coronado. They were people who might one week be out sabotaging a bighorn sheep hunt, and then the next week they were, you know, trying to stop logging roads from being built in roadless areas. So this is sort of what I came up into and how I thought everyone sort of operated. And of course, later I found out that there were tensions and that there were divisions and that there was an argument about, I think an unfortunate argument about the life of a species and the life of an individual. I think anarcho-feminism has taught us that both the collective and the individual can be protected and honored and preserved. And I think that as animal rights activists, I think we need to start thinking about both the collective, the species as a whole, and the individuals as being important. But yeah, to close, I never really saw any necessary friction there. And I think that for those of us who primarily identify as animal liberationists, we need to do our best to take some of that tension down a notch.
Well, we're back. My name's Paul Rowland, and I've got Tim, Justin, and Melanie in the studio with the collective that is organizing the third annual Resistance Ecology Conference. And that was a talk from the first conference in 2013 by Josh Harper, who went to prison as part of the crackdown on the Stop Huntington Animal Cruelty campaign, which is worth possibly even talking about for a few minutes, because the ramifications of just the model of organizing that they did and the ramifications of the crackdown on that campaign have a lot of lessons for us. But just what he talked about, I thought that was in 4 minutes, he brought up a lot of really, really interesting stuff. Any thoughts off the bat?
I mean, I think that sets a good tone for where this conference is coming. And I think perhaps one of the biggest ironies about talks like that is that we're talking about even a better bridge building between radical environmental communities and animal liberation communities, which perhaps on paper look like they have so many shared goals, but oftentimes, and the irony also of living in the Northwest and organizing with a group like Animal Defense League, like Tim mentioned, while there was an active Earth First chapter at the time, and those two groups having no idea what the campaigns were, like no idea like who the people were, it speaks volumes to the state of things that two communities that seemingly have so many common and shared goals are so disparate is an indicator that we really have a lot of work to do. And for the most part, it's hard to find out what the real issues are other than minor differences between, I guess, particular human-oriented ideologies that matter to them, that matter to these communities more, their perfectionism, their puritanism, than perhaps the actual goals. And I think he does a good job of speaking about what really is the underlying drive of this group of people and this hopefully new wave in the animal liberation movement is a reminder that it's not about puritanism, it's not about building a vegan empire across the world. It's about, which that's an existing thing, a group called the Vegan Empire.
Vegan imperialism? There is something called the Vegan Empire?
I think it's, I don't really know exactly what it is, but there is an existing thing called Vegan Empire. And it's really not. It's really about building a better world for all species, and that should be the bottom line, and that there's a lot of ways to do that, and we certainly don't have a formula that's working amazingly, and so I don't understand why we can't begin to critique ourselves in moving forward.
Yeah, I'd just like to add, you know, I'd like to think that the Resistance Ecology Conference has kind of helped also set the tone year by year. I feel like the general dialogue that's happening around animal liberation, particularly in the more radical circles, is becoming much more critical of itself and is willing to, you know, put aside differences like the you're not vegan, you know, difference, and really kind of focus in on where those common goals and strategies are. And a lot of campaign development at this point that has been born out of the conference actually has moved in that direction. And that's really exciting. And I really hope that this conference and any organizing that happens in the future follows that model.
So I realize we haven't actually said where and when this conference. Melanie, I wonder if you could, because, you know, before people, you know, people are going to be leaving the show, and we want to definitely at least let them know what's happening specifically and also give them the website. So maybe you could talk about, I didn't print out, I guess, Friday. There is something happening on Friday?
I think Justin can speak to Friday's event a little bit better than I can.
Yeah, Friday at 7 o'clock at Matt Dishman Community Center, which is in Northeast. I think it's on...
Russell. It's on Russell.
It's on Russell.
It's off campus.
An off-campus event. It's actually coordinated primarily by Social Justice Fund. It is a collaborative event, including a lot of community co-sponsors. Resistance Ecology is one aspect of that, in addition to Portland Vegans of Color. Actually, Food Fight Vegan Grocery is also helping, but it's an event with Lauren Ornelas, who's one of the speakers, who's actually been at the conference every year. She's sort of a great person that encapsulates a lot of the original critiques of these trends in the animal rights movement even two decades ago. And so she's always a great voice to have on. Anyway, the event is called Community Self-Determination Through Food Justice, and is a sort of a look at how food in and of itself is something you could sort of a thread you could start tugging on and realize there's a whole host of issues that ranging from animal exploitation, worker exploitation, migrant justice, food scarcity in communities of color, et cetera, that she'll be speaking on. And there'll be a variety of groups tabling, and also sort of the project of the conference kind of led us to this point with Social Justice Fund, where they wanted to have her speak off campus to be able to reach communities that are actually most impacted by this. Not often, a lot of the conference attendees are not going to be representative of those communities a lot of the time. And so that was sort of what we wanted to do on Friday night. And then I'll let Melanie sort of speak to, you know, the rest of the stuff going on at Portland State.
So where is it going to be, first of all?
So the bulk of the conference, the Saturday and Sunday events, this upcoming Saturday and Sunday, are at Portland State University in the Student Union, Smith Memorial Student Union. And basically, we have three talks each block. So we have... two in the morning, two blocks in the morning, so six talks in the morning. And the mornings kind of focus on more practical things, like we have Know Your Rights trainings and prisoner letter writing, things like that, like a little bit shorter, kind of more tangible, practical things. And then in the afternoons on Saturday and Sunday, we have like a little bit longer blocks where things get a little bit more theoretical, and I think it gets... a little bit more, you know, the work becomes harder, you know, it becomes subjects that are a little bit more difficult for, you know, a lot of Portland vegans who are just vegan because it's cool to be vegan to stomach or, you know, to deal with.
For example?
What's a good one? Oh, there's one that's titled Why Animal Liberation is Stopping Us from Animal Liberation, which I thought was... so, like, things like that, like how this movement is holding itself back.
I think every movement should have discussions like that. In my personal experience, I don't know, maybe I'm wrong, but I feel like the whole spirit of criticism, self-criticism, which kind of maybe got a bad rap because kind of like this Maoist kind of thing, you know, it's kind of like it's hardcore. But actually, I've heard it was like really, when it's really done in a good spirit, it's like you just automatically do it. It's like you're always reflecting and people are reflecting back on you. Anyway, it always starts, and criticism, self-criticism always starts with self-criticism. So, anyway, please continue.
Oh, yeah. No, I just think the afternoons are definitely a little bit more of a time to... reflect on, I think, your own like views and values about veganism or animal liberation or land defense. It's definitely a time when I come back with, you know, some very valuable pieces of information that have stuck with me since I've been going to the conferences, which I appreciate and enjoy. This will definitely be, I think, the most like confrontational conference. I think a lot of people are going to be really thrown off and confused because so much of it does not focus on animal liberation or animal rights. I think a lot of people who are going because they think, you know, it's going to be about like us sitting around talking about how cool it is to be vegan are going to be really confused happening. Sure. No, I mean, like, I mean, I'm vegan myself, but, you know, I think it'll definitely be a wake-up call for a lot of people that are very passively vegan. So I think it'll be good. I'm very excited about it. It'll be good.
Yeah, and if you are one of those vegans that hasn't been to something in a while out there in Portland, this would really be a great time to come out and join something.
And if this sparks your, this whatever gets your dander up or makes you think or you have something that you want to respond to or contribute to this conversation, please call us up. The phone lines are open, 503-231-8187. I want to ask you another thing, Melanie, if I could, but I want to let people know that we are having some guests. Lauren Regan of the Civil Liberty Defense Center, a truly remarkable human being who's been doing such amazing work for so long, is going to be on at 9 o'clock, so you want to stay tuned for that. 9:30, Eric McDavid is going to be calling in. If those of you don't know, he spent way too many years in prison for something I don't even know if he really thought about actually doing. I think it like maybe was a fleeting thing that crossed his mind and he said something and he got put in jail for that, right? Something like that.
Anyway. I mean, it was totally entrapment, but yeah. He can speak to that.
Yeah, we'll let him speak to that. He can speak freely now, right? Mm-hmm. Obviously, he's going in. That's good. Because some people have these restrictions for years after getting out. Jonathan Paul might also be calling in. Probably around that same time. And we're not sure. We're hoping to have a bunch of other people. Kana Hoos, who's a Secwepemc warrior woman from British Columbia. She had agreed to come on, but she was on a show of mine a few weeks ago. But I haven't heard back from her. We may be hearing from her. But she is scheduled to be at the conference. We did want to talk about people who can't be at the conference in a bit. But I did want to ask you, Melanie, so, and then kind of following up, I want to ask you guys about your kind of longer perspective on it. But so, you know, you've gone to this conference for a couple of years. So, you know, I know like when I was a lot younger, like, you know, like going to conferences like this was like a really big deal for me because, you know, you'd like meet all these amazing people and like learn all these new stuff. So it seems like this conference is something like that for, you know, a new generation of activists. Is it your feeling?
Yeah, well, I think it's definitely like exciting to see people who you've heard of, you know, speak to you, like they're right there and, you know, you get a little like starstruck and it's like exciting. Now I'm not quite there, but like, you know, it's still exciting. Maybe I still am there and I just won't admit it. But, no, I do think it's, I think it's really great, and it's a good way to start getting into activism is like something like this conference, this is how you get started in activism, because it's like, it sets a good tone for, you know, encompassing so many different types of movements and different thought, that I think it's like a good platform for how you should inform your activism, or how I feel like I should inform my activism, I guess. Which is like very intersectional activism, which I feel like Tim and Justin also would agree with, which is good. It's nice to like have found people that also feel the same way about having a well-rounded activist movement going.
So on that note, I mean, you know, it's like there is this kind of siloing of activism and social movements that people talk about. And I've certainly seen it over the years. People tend to, you know, and it's kind of a natural thing. It's like you need to focus. You find people who share similar interests. I mean, there's nothing necessarily wrong with it. But given the dire situation that we're in, and I it would scare me, frankly, to be a lot younger than I am in some sense, even though I've certainly got a good two or three decades left if all goes well. But the way things are coming down, it's like if we don't get over these, you know, these like ingrained differences, these, you know, which are real differences, and I don't want to dismiss or belittle the differences, but it seems like, so the question is, over, you know, I don't know, the last 6, 8, 10 years, do you see, you know, this intersectionality that you've been talking about, do you see that like making headway? Do you see that more people are starting to get that? Is that starting to break down to some extent?
I first want to just give a shout out to the folks who are helping organize this conference that actually aren't here with us, because they're also, this is also the first year that they've done it. So there is actually more people that are just now getting involved in this sort of stuff than there are people that have been doing it for a long time. I say, like, myself and Tim have been doing it for all 3 years, but there are other people. And so that is just sort of
Haley and Philip, that's for you.
To go off of what Melanie was saying a bit about seeing that it actually is having some effect, at least that we're actually getting people involved, wanting to know how the processes work in the first place. But so just want to say thank you to them, since they're not with us, they couldn't join us today.
Well, and it's worth mentioning too, there are some really incredible people that have been volunteering, some of which that's every true. Year that we have established relationships with now, and that's also really exciting. So thank you to them as well.
To answer your question, I think I'm eternally critical of things, as self-critical, I should say, too. The conference 3 years ago started off with a lot of rhetoric about quote-unquote intersectionality. I personally have shifted away from that language. I think if you follow sort of some of the presentation titles and also even just the write-up for this year's conference as opposed to the first year, you notice that that word isn't used. That's partially because it's become trending in some regards within, it's really an issue I say is particular to the animal rights movement. I don't feel comfortable speaking and criticizing movements that I'm not actively more engaged in. That it's in vogue to some extent. There's an analysis out there. People understand this idea of the interconnectedness of all oppression or what have you. There are plenty of blogs that have it. You can read about it. You can sort of adopt it, self-identify with the so-called intersectional animal rights movement. But on the ground, nothing has changed. And I would say over the last decade or so, you know, these critiques are not unique. They've existed maybe less prominently, but perhaps because the force of social media has changed. But they have existed. Like I said, Lauren Ornelas is an example of someone who's always been waging these critiques of the movement for 2 decades. And now it's popular to talk about this stuff, but we still don't organize in a grassroots fashion, at least. We still don't really organize around those principles. I think it's partially because it's incredibly difficult to imagine what does that look like practically. I think it's also because intersectionality is a little too easy for animal rights folks to adopt. I think it's easy to say things like, well, if all connection is interconnected, if all oppression is interconnected, then by doing animal rights work, we are in fact doing the work for all these other communities as well. Because again, if you pull on one thread, is the web not so connected that if you're trying to work for the liberation of one, you're working for the liberation of all? And it's essentially just become a shield to deflect criticisms of existing problems. I still think that it allows, that the movement now still allows for way too much racism. I mean, in Europe, it's hard to differentiate between fascist animal liberation groups, particularly in France, and ones that are actively anti-fascist. And in the United States, that's a little bit more tacit. And I think that we definitely allow for a movement that does not offer itself to lend support to, let's say, the last year as an example of existing, like, continued police violence on communities of color, yet we are still willing to use police and prosecution if it means that we get results for or perceived results for animals. An example would be cruelty convictions, where after a major investigation of, say, a factory farm, we bring in prosecution to convict low-wage workers, often many of whom are undocumented migrants, who have actually been deported after these instances, all under the guise of advocating for animals, because they get some misdemeanor charges, some fines slapped on them, they get sent within the prison industrial complex. Big animal rights groups use that as a fundraising push.
Okay, wait a second.
This is a specific
I've heard what you're saying, but I haven't really tuned into it. So, I mean, are not the big groups, PETA, et cetera, are they not like criticizing these law enforcement activities for not going for the higher ups in those?
Rarely, if ever.
Yeah, I mean, whenever these types of investigations happen, I mean, some of the worst ones come from Mercy for Animals, which are really incredible, like, and by incredible, I mean horrific footage of what goes on inside of these factory farms. And, you know, I mean, these are the types of videos that if you watch, you probably can consider stopping eating meat. But, you know, when the hammer falls on and there's action taken against what is being seen, a lot of times, you know, American laws are being broken. All of the faces you see go up on the websites that are using this as fundraising push, you know, are not the people that actually are the owners of these farms. It's oftentimes people of color or migrants that are swept up. And
it should also be said that they face horrible working conditions as well. I mean, and it's never again, this is sort of the irony, is that these same groups are adopting this, you know, let's care about other communities as well, intersectional rhetoric, and they'll have maybe a blog post here and there about the connection between human rights and animal rights, yet these same groups are pushing this rhetoric where they're actually commending prosecutors. I mean, you could look at the blog posts when this stuff goes up and actually read, like, we want to give a big thanks to such and such district attorney's office for acting, you know, firmly on this issue and acting swiftly to make sure that justice is served, blah, blah, blah. It's a rhetoric that legitimizes state violence against not only animals, but of a wide base of communities. I don't want to speak too much to this issue because I think your question was a little bit more broad, but it is a good sort of microscopic example or microcosmic example of the ways in which things on the ground have not changed very much, even though our rhetoric has changed. And I think that the term intersectionality itself is a good example because it has a long history in outside of it was never really meant for the animal rights community. I mean, the term doesn't even really apply to the idea of the interconnectedness of oppression. It's really speaking to the experiences of particularly Black women who can't be just a woman or can't just be Black, but they have intersecting experiences. And so I think it's kind of ironic that most AR folks that are out there talking that talk probably don't even know the word's history. And so
I don't have to say this, but I actually don't recall having known that myself.
And that's fine. I mean, like, I'm a white dude talking about it, and I think that should absolutely be noted. But the point being is that I think there are better ways, and the conference has sort of shifted over the years towards thinking that there are better ways to actually talk about these issues that don't allow for us to continue this sort of, like, saviorist approach. And those, you know, moving forward with things like coalition building or doing solidarity work that can actually seat us in a particular position where we acknowledge that there are important differences, as you mentioned there. We don't want to say that it's all the same. This is not about homogenization of liberation. It's really about acknowledging that these different facets of liberation movements do have unique histories. They do have unique experiences, some of which are shared, some of which are not, some of which are interdependent. But that the legitimacy of them all is grounded in this idea of liberation and self-determination. And, you know, there are ways in which we can engage in that work where we have to prioritize the needs of other communities as opposed to just saying, oh, well, since everything is interconnected, let's just do animal work and then call it good. And I think that those things are also starting to rear their heads as part of the dialogue. But in terms of, like, the organizing or the campaigns and stuff, you don't, even in the grassroots, this is partially because the grassroots of animal liberation movement is mostly dead. It's really hard to see that translate into the work.
Yeah, you don't see I guess I did hear of a release of some animals
in Ontario.
Yeah, a few days ago, but
Canada has been alive lately.
You don't hear about it nearly as much as you did, I don't know, 15 years ago or something. But anyway, well said, Justin. I don't know, either we've got everybody so spellbound they just can't call in, or they're waiting for the second hour. I mean, I've usually had like several calls by now, so I don't know what's going on out there, but we would love to hear from you. We enjoy talking to ourselves, and we think we're interesting, but you might have some interesting to say too. 503-231-8187. Any continuations of the conversation?
Yeah, I wanted to actually. Justin tends to be a lot more critical, I think, in general, which is really good. But I feel like along with the conference and even some of the grassroots, there actually is this kind of framework that is being used in some grassroots organizing right now. And a campaign here in the Northwest that's really been taking off lately is the No New Animal Lab campaign, which is really kind of, you know, it's galvanized support. There's a lot of it's a campaign basically to stop the construction of the animal research and care facility at the University of Washington, targeting University of Washington and its construction partner, Skanska USA. It is a pressure campaign, which Justin and another really amazing organizer, Amanda Shemkis, will be talking about, along with Dylan Powell at the conference as well. But this everything we're discussing is being practiced in this campaign. And while this campaign is being specifically specifically targeting the construction of this lab, all of the people that are involved in the campaign, the organizers and people that are regular attendees to protests and such, are regularly supporting other movements and have built really strong relationships with organizers from other movements that has really helped in action planning and in getting the message out there about what is happening at the University of Washington. And so I feel like even though that's just a small little thing, it is happening. And we just hope that, you know, people will now see this, you know, framework in action and adopt it in their own circles and their own campaigns.
So we do have a couple callers. We will go to them in a second. After, at some point, you know, I realize we haven't talked. I don't know if people even know where animals are being experimented on, mistreated, et cetera, right in the Portland area. So we should definitely mention that, because there have been campaigns against that over the years. But let's go to our first caller. James, you're on the air.
Good morning.
Hello.
Morning.
Hey. So I have a question. How do you? So I mean, it sounds like both of our guests are vegan. How do you explain to other vegans the importance of? Looking at like indigenous cultures, like Native Americans. You know, their importance of how their view of animals, while they're not vegan, that their view of animals is important. I don't know, maybe I'm not framing this right, but how do you explain to other vegans the importance of something like that? Just because, I mean, like, if you look at Native American culture, they had such immense respect for animals, even though they did consume them and use their hides to make, you know, to make things, but, I mean, even if you look back then, even with the amount of, you know, bison that they were killing to be able to live, that you would say that things were in much better shape now, even though we have veganism. But you know what I mean?
Let's let him give a shot at an answer. Thanks.
Okay.
Thanks. I think that we all do actually understand that question, partially because it's always been an aspect of, like, again, some of that tension when we do offer critiques like this in the form of a conference, we're going to get some backlash about it, because I think it's hard. It's definitely hard for people that have maybe, especially ones who have recently adopted a vegan diet, they really think that this is the end all be all. It makes a lot of sense at first that, oh, well, I mean, if we just don't engage in like any consumption that is harming animals, then this truly will have a major impact in that in any way are we engaging those economic institutions in a positive way, like giving them our money. We're not only fueling further exploitation of animals, and when we consume them in our bodies, it's a great disrespect. And it's this absolutist mentality that does make sense at first because you get into it and you're angry. And I think absolutism is the solution that most people want. They want something that's absolute. But over time, when you really think about how complicated a lot of this stuff is, and that there are other institutions at play, it's absolutism just doesn't exist in that sense. And first, with because this question seems to be mostly framed around indigenous solidarity. I think that the biggest thing any vegan, especially ones on North America or so-called North America, should really recognize is that we are settlers on occupied territory. I speak for myself, and I imagine everyone else in the room. We'd be settlers on occupied territory. This is the territory of the Chinook peoples. It's very hard to talk about what others should and should not do when you're a representative of probably the most destructive colonial empire in history. And so to say that everyone should adopt a vegan diet because it's the one that best advocates for animals without understanding that veganism in and of itself is really a part of this colonial project. That in reality, if we built a vegan world that still played into American capitalism, how is that helping animals at all? I mean, we're still a part of the most destructive culture on the planet. Can veganism just be assimilated into it? And I don't think it can. Two, I don't think it really acknowledges that the sort of incredibly systematic ways in which this whole continent and other places like Palestine are being transformed by these colonial nation states that consume all ecological diversity. They consume life every step of the way, along with new settlements, along with building these new aspects of the colonial project, that we are here talking about veganism in a vacuum, not acknowledging that if this continent had never been subject to European settlement, regardless of whether or not animals were being consumed by indigenous cultures here, everyone should acknowledge it would be better for animals. I think that's sort of the basic framing I would go with when talking to other vegans, to be like, if the US never existed, everything would be better for animals. And that's across the globe. And I said this once at a talk in Massachusetts where people got really weirded out. And this was to a crowd of people that had like either just became vegetarian or vegan. I said something about how the US shouldn't exist. And it sounds really weird, but it's like, I mean, think about it. I mean, this is a country that's just over 200 years old. Europeans have been here for about 500 years. This is not the way the world has to be, but we accept it so much that we do think about veganism because it's like an insular absolutist solution to a problem that does in no way address really the true systematic nature of animal exploitation. It didn't just start because people wanted to start hurting animals. It has roots that are far deeper than that, particularly within a capitalist and colonial system.
Well, I think it makes people uncomfortable. I mean, and not just, you know, like you bring these things up on some of these discussion groups, like climate change discussion is one I like to mention, which is like a scary place. But, you know, you've got all these really bedrock, you know, America firsters or whatever, you know, that bedrock mentality of, you know, lift yourself up by your own bootstraps, rugged individualism, you know, big government is bad, you know, free enterprise, all this stuff, whatever. And but, you know, people, like you say, who think that they're looking at the world through a different lens, still, I mean, we are products of this society. It's like we are products of that colonial process. So it's like, you know, in the sense it undermines your foundation. You may not recognize that consciously, but it creates a certain cognitive dissonance. If anybody else wants to chime in before we go to our next caller.
For the call, I actually think that's a really great topic. And in fact, this is something that is going to be addressed at the conference. In fact, actually, one of the conference attendees, Dylan Powell, he actually wrote an excellent essay.
A series of essays, actually.
Yeah, Veganism and the Occupied Territories. He lives in Canada.
St. Catharines.
For the caller, I would definitely suggest reading that. But also, you know, it's important. I think there's been a lot of discussion kind of about, particularly within the animal rights community, which you know, is a lot of movement people in the community identify as white. And there has been much more discussion about kind of unpacking the privilege of whiteness. You know, like I myself, and I am a white male, and I feel like I'm still, as much as I'm trying, I'm still constantly trying to educate myself and finding myself in conversations with my partner, you know, saying things that are representative of the fact that I was raised a white boy. And so that's something that we, as many of us as vegans, need to constantly be challenging and thinking critically of. And that's a good starting point as well.
Well, let's go to our next caller. Tom, you're on the air.
Oh, great. Hi. Are you there?
Uh-huh.
Hello?
Yeah, you're there. You're here. We're here.
Oh, great. Okay. I've been listening to your show, enjoy it very much, and agree with a lot of what you're saying, or everything you're saying. I always bring up, you know, I've been reading some essays by Gary Snyder, you know, the beat poet. He went to Reed College and is kind of from the West Coast, a native West Coast, and kind of has a lot of deep knowledge of and identifies with a lot of the things you're talking about. But in this essay from the early 70s, he brought up the two issues that still are so pervasive and so important to, that sort of override even what you're talking about, and they are greed, of course, which is the Occupy movement, and then human overpopulation is the other one. And I don't know why people don't talk about it more.
So wait a second, you said override about?
Okay. Human, too many people on the planet. Mm-hmm. Human overpopulation. The fact that there's factory farming going on and, you know, environmental degradation, it really is rooted in two things, which are greed on the one hand and overpopulation. And the two things are kind of a intertwined Mobius strip. The more people that you need to feed, the more you need factory farms and junk food and processed ways of doing it. And the more people are become dehumanized to what they're actually doing.
But I just want to push back briefly. So,
sure.
I don't understand why you say they override what we're talking about.
It doesn't. I didn't. Maybe I used the wrong word. Override meaning, until you solve the issue of human overpopulation and greed, those two sort of intertwined things, I don't see how you can really solve anything else, because nothing is going to be solved until we do something about it, and we're not really doing anything about it. There was a lot of environmentalists in the early 70s who were talking about it, like an Earth Day and that era, but for some reason it's become politically incorrect to talk about
it. Well, let's have one of our guests respond and stay on the line.
Okay. Great.
Yeah, no, I think you bring up an interesting point. Like, you can't do anything until you solve, like, the issue of greed. But, you know, that's, like, how, you know, like, that's a good thing to say, and yeah, I agree, but
right.
What do you, how are you going to solve the issue of greed? You know, I think
you guys brought it up quite well, which is saying we need more, I mean, in Naomi Klein's book about global warming and the other book called The Shock Doctrine, we just need more government regulation. There's no question about it. We cannot let corporate power and run rampantly to the point where there's a total dehumanization of the way we live. You know, there's some great movies, like one is Soylent Green, which is a movie from the early 70s, which is addressing a lot of what you're talking about, where society has reached the point where they have to eat other humans in order to survive.
Okay, we actually have to let you go, because we got Lauren Regan coming up, and she's a very busy woman. But yeah, we would like to address that. I would like to start off by saying that, I mean, you know, this is an issue that would take a long conversation to seriously address. But what I think you're not saying is that what is the actual origin of what you call it greed. I mean, that's like kind of a vague thing to say, but of overpopulation itself. And I would assert that it's the certain, you have to get at the structural dynamics that actually lead. I mean, if you look at modern overpopulation, it's basically a result of the capitalist system. I mean, so overpopulation, is it a cause or is it an effect? I mean, and that's an age-old question. What's cause and what's... It becomes both a cause of further misery and great... obviously, there's too many people. And anyone who denies that, I mean, it is a... And there are, you know, that is kind of a taboo subject, maybe for the reasons that you're thinking. I don't know. And, but it's like, but the way to resolve it is not, you know, is not through government regulation, I don't think. Anyway, you guys want to...
I just want to say quickly about that is, I completely agree. I think the question of whether or not it is a cause or an effect is something that has not been fleshed out well. There's an abundance of data that suggests that it is a result of capitalism, particularly more modern neoliberalism and globalization, development projects, et cetera, in areas where leading peasant populations to have to rely on increased population rate in order to even maintain the resources that they need to survive.
And the control of women, if you read absolutely. Sylvia Federici's book, mm-hmm. The Caliban of the Witch, is brilliant analysis of that.
It's absolutely, the reason that the caller might think it's a taboo subject is because oftentimes it is fuel for pre-existing sort of latent notions of sexism and racism that particularly place blame on women of color for not just maintaining their breeding rate or whatever you want to say, quote unquote. Okay. So I do think it's like, if you're going to talk about overpopulation, you should acknowledge that you are entering a territory where which allows for a lot of growth of things like racism or sexism to take hold of that discussion. If you're not talking about the economic systems and the social forces at play, you're not really doing anyone any good. I also will note the sake of it that I do have a vasectomy, so I do care about these issues, but it's not as if that I think that sort of thing works. Also, there is an abundance of data from China that does indicate that government regulations have not done a great job in maintaining.
Thanks for sharing, though.
Anyway. Yeah, Justin and I are actually both very proud of our award that we have from the Voluntary Human Extinction Program for our vasectomies.
Oh my gosh!
With that, on that note, I would like to let everybody know that it is coming on 9:01 in the morning, and you are listening to KBOO Portland, and this is a community radio. And if you haven't heard us before, thank you for tuning in. And if you're a regular listener, we appreciate your tuning in, whether it's by...